Coming up on this week's Book Show, Casey Sapp's Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee looks at the dual mysteries of a notorious crime and a famous novelist's attempt to write about it. She brings the story to life, from the shocking murders to the courtroom drama to the racial politics of the Deep South. At the same time, she offers a deeply moving portrait of Harper Lee and her struggle with fame. Casey Sapp on this week's Book Show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Casey Sepp's new book, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, looks at the dual mysteries of a notorious crime and a famous novelist's attempt to write about it. Reverend Willie Maxwell was a rural preacher accused of murdering five of his family members for insurance money in the 1970s. With the help of a savvy lawyer, he escaped justice for years until a relative shot him dead at the funeral of his last victim. Despite hundreds of witnesses, Maxwell's murderer was acquitted, thanks to the same attorney who had previously defended the Reverend. Sepp brings this story to life, from the shocking murders to the courtroom drama to the racial politics of the Deep South. At the same time, she offers a deeply moving portrait of Harper Lee and her struggle with fame, success, and the mystery of artistic creativity. Again, the new book is Furious Hours. It is a pleasure to welcome Casey Sepp to this week's Book Show. Casey, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
What brought you initially to the story?
Oh, gosh. I think, like a lot of young readers, I was completely captivated by To Kill a Mockingbird when I encountered the book as a child. And, you know, I just loved Scout Finch as a heroine, and I was a daddy's girl, and I was a tomboy. So I just really developed an affection and an affinity for that novel. And I had always wanted to see Monroeville, the town where Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, was born and raised, since it had been the model for Macomb, the town in the novel. And so in 2015, like a lot of journalists, I headed down to Monroeville after the surprising announcement that Harper Lee would be publishing a new book. And while I was there reporting for The New Yorker on Go Set a Watchman, I learned of this other project that Harper Lee had undertaken in the 70s, this kind of surprising and quite different project involving, you know, a true crime story that she hoped to turn into a nonfiction book. So my knowledge of this case really only dates to 2015, and over the last 4 years, I've built out this book and gotten to know the original story and learned a lot more about her as a writer, what drew her to this case, and her ambitions as a journalist, and ultimately her struggles as a writer, why she couldn't complete this project.
How soon after learning the story did you know how you wanted to go after it? Because it really becomes a balance between the case itself and the story of Harper Lee.
Sure. So in 2015, I wrote a short article for The New Yorker's website about one of the characters in the book, an attorney named Tom Radney. So this is the same attorney who had originally represented the Reverend and then represented the vigilante who murdered the Reverend. And that article pertained to some files that Tom Radney had given Harper Lee when she was first researching this case. And it was a little bit of a kind of, you know, document and archival mystery. And I was already tremendously interested, and in the course of reporting that article, learned about a lot more documents and a lot more people who had interacted with Harper Lee when she was researching and investigating this case. And it just seemed like there was more and more material, and that this tremendously interesting part of her life had been previously neglected, and that it was the chance to write about a writer I admired in the prime of her life undertaking, you know, this tremendously ambitious project. And one that harkened to an earlier period of her life when she'd helped Truman Capote report In Cold Blood. So it was really the opportunity to look at, you know, the original crime story and look at the role of religion in small town Southern life. And because of the lawyer who, you know, would see you from one part of the story to the other, you could talk about the law and the influence of these, you know, kind of small town trials on people's sense of law and order and the criminal justice system. And that attorney had also had a tremendously interesting political career. So I thought, okay, we've got another character who can kind of walk us through the paces of liberalism in the South during the Wallace years. And then, of course, here was Harper Lee, one of my favorite authors, and the chance to really reckon with her in a serious and intellectual way. So it seemed, you know, pretty early on, like it might be more than an article. And in fact, that article ends with the line that the Radney family, because by that point, Tom was already deceased, you know, the Radney family is sanguine that if Harper Lee didn't write the book, someone else will. And, you know, it just sat there thinking, well, why not me? and that's the book grew out of that original reporting. So pretty quickly, it seemed like it wanted to be a longer, kind of more thoughtful treatment of the case and of Harper Lee herself.
Let me just take a step back. So in 2015, you head south as Ghost of a Watchman was announced, and we found out that this book was going to come out. How did you feel about the publication?
Tricky question. I think that, you know, Ghost of a Watchman was a manuscript that, you know, really divided fans of Harper Lee and readers of literary fiction in general. So the first thing to note is that Ghost of a Watchman, you know, there are these questions about the provenance of the manuscript, and it was absolutely written by Harper Lee. It's just somewhat confusingly, even though that novel is a sequel in terms of chronology, meaning, you know, Scout Finch and her father are much older than they are in To Kill a Mockingbird, and Jem Finch is dead right as the novel opens. So it's a sequel in terms of chronology, but it's a prequel in terms of when Harper Lee wrote it. And the critical thing to note is that it is a draft of a novel that she submitted to publishers in 1958, and she completed no additional revisions or edits to prior to its publication in 2015. So I think so long as readers understand that manuscript history, you know, they read it with the idea that here was a young Harper Lee just starting out as a novelist, and not Harper Lee in the prime of her life, you know, 50 years after To Kill a Mockingbird, returning to the same characters in the same story. You know, so long as we encounter it as a draft, as an early attempt, you know, as the first version of Macomb and Macomb County, then I think it's a wonderfully interesting literary artifact. You know, I don't fault readers who were confused, because there's no kind of preface or introductory material that would remind you of that fact. And so it was delivered in a sort of confusing way, because I think for a lot of people, they got very excited at the notion that for five decades, the novelist Harper Lee had been, you know, returning to her greatest character, sort of like Margaret Atwood is about to do this fall with The Handmaid's Tale.
Right.
And, you know, for that reason, it was probably tremendously disappointing and maybe even confusing, because, in fact, you know, Ghost of a Watchman is not as aesthetically good a novel as To Kill a Mockingbird. And so I think the confusion came for readers who thought, oh, gosh, Harper Lee became a worse writer, not a better one. And I wish that there had been a little bit more packaging around it, you know, an introduction by an academic or anyone who's written, you know, kind of biographically about her that would have clarified that history. Because, you know, for lovers of literature, those kinds of documents are really fascinating. And, you know, it's like a couple of years ago, this collection of Elizabeth Bishop's drafts and fragments and manuscript materials came out, and we learned a lot about her as a writer. And, you know, you could follow her through the revision process, and it was biographically revealing in ways that, you know, a lot of her complete and published poetry had never been. And what a wonderful contribution to the world of poetry and our knowledge of such a gifted poet. And, you know, if that had been the way every reader came to Ghost of a Watchman, thinking about, you know, this tremendously interesting editorial relationship between Lee and the editor at Lippincott who helped her complete Mockingbird, where we could see the kinds of choices around character and setting and plot, you know, every choice could be admired and appreciated, you know, that we could see how Watchmen became such a better novel. That would have been wonderful. But instead, again, for a lot of folks, there was this disappointment about, oh, gosh, you know, in 50 years, that's all she could do. in 50 years, you know, that's how her politics changed. And so that left me with some regret and disappointment. But, you know, I love Harper Lee's work. Getting to read any of it is a gift. And for that reason, you know, I'm glad that a lot of people would get to read it. I just wish, you know, the kind of terms and details of the manuscript maybe had been better communicated.
I agree with you entirely, and especially love the use of the term literary artifact, that if it was put into a larger volume that gave you an idea of how the novel To Kill a Mockingbird came about and went from Ghost at a Watchman to Kill a Mockingbird would be fascinating in an authoritative sense. So then you find out that there is this other book, and what then can you say as a result of the writing in this nonfiction that really is the only clue that we have as to how Harper Lee progressed as a writer?
First of all, I just think straightforwardly, you know, if you'd given me 10,000 years to think about what Harper Lee was up to after To Kill a Mockingbird, I would never have dreamed of The Reverend, the story of, you know, this incredibly fascinating and gripping and strange and sort of gothic story over on the other side of Alabama. So right off the bat, I think that her choice of subject tells us a little bit about her ambitions as a writer and her eagerness to reckon with more complicated characters and, you know, a more complicated story of race and criminal justice in the South. So what we learned from the draft of Watchmen, but also a lot of correspondence that came out after that publication, is that Harper Lee, while immensely satisfied with the kind of aesthetic improvements that became To Kill a Mockingbird, was frustrated by the fact that she had had to create a kind of more palatable story of race relations in the South, and where she had wanted to write about, you know, the Dixiecrats and the kind of tension between the sort of gentlemanly figures in the South who, you know, would never have supported a lynching but didn't mind segregated churches, schools, you know, diners, that sort of thing. She wanted to write about those kinds of people, and instead she was forced to, you know, create a kind of fairy tale, or encouraged to. Of course, she wasn't forced. She had a choice in it all. But, you know, it was surprising to her how popular the novel became, because ultimately it was so much more politically simplistic than the draft she had originally created. And so I think what's most interesting about this business over in Alexander City, this true crime story, is that it is very complicated. So it's a white lawyer profiting off these cases involving black bodies. And it was a black minister accused of killing his own family members, you know, a black vigilante who was ultimately acquitted of a murder. And so she's already just at the outset kind of sinking her teeth into a more complicated story. And the fact that she wanted to write nonfiction is tremendously interesting. You know, she had done a little bit of journalism in the years after To Kill a Mockingbird. She had a column in the student newspaper. Her father was a newspaper editor, so she's completely familiar with the terms of journalism. And having helped Capote, she'd really seen what it took to put together a book like In Cold Blood. So it's already at the outset just tremendously interesting to know that this is what Harper Lee was up to from 1977 forward. You know, she spent the 60s struggling with these other ideas for novels, and, you know, she had tried and tried and tried to produce a second novel, but then she turns to nonfiction. So, you know, even if we didn't see any of the writing around this project, knowing that she spent a year, you know, knocking on doors, conducting interviews, buying copies of court transcripts, sitting in on trials, getting to know law enforcement officers and lawyers, it's just quite interesting to know that's the task she set herself to. And, you know, again, correspondence is very revealing, so we can see, you know, what interested her in this choice of story, what she found energizing, what she found frustrating. And all of that is just, you know, an insight into the kind of writer and intellectual she was.
Casey Sepp is our guest on this week's book show. The new book, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. She tried so hard to be private, to have her work and her life out of the public eye. And as you read in this book, I mean, she was going up to people and saying, "Hi, I'm Harper Lee. Can I talk to you about this?"
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's extremely incongruous. You know, I think we have this notion of Harper Lee, the recluse or the antisocial or the, you know, kind of small town rubish writer. And instead, here she is undertaking this tremendously social project, which requires her to be in conversation with strangers, which requires her to get to know the inner lives of people who are quite different from her. So we know, for instance, that, you know, the Reverend was accused of killing five family members, and that meant that Harper Lee had to go and interview, you know, these African-American community members who had been witness to his crimes or who were related to his victims. She interviewed the black vigilante who murdered the Reverend. You know, she was spending time in these tiny hamlets around Coosa County and Tallapoosa County, Alabama, truly just, you know, coming up to strangers and asking them to tell them, you know, tell her their life stories. And beyond that, you know, she was going to cocktail parties in town. When people would say, you know, would you come for lunch? She would go for pimento cheese sandwiches and sign copies of To Kill a Mockingbird for them. And so she was really just getting around town, so much so that, you know, people were asking for interviews and contacting her at the motel where she was staying because word really got out. You know, she had not succeeded in the way she had in New York of staying anonymous. In fact, it was incumbent upon her, you know, to introduce herself and explain her project. And that's why we have such a tremendous body of evidence about her work on this case, because, you know, when you go and you contact, you know, the court reporter from the vigilante's trial, part of her experience of narrating that original criminal trial is telling you about the time she talked to Harper Lee about it all. And, you know, it's just it's incredible. And it's wonderful to think of, you know, a writer who we think we know so well surprising us so immensely with this period of activity and this enthusiasm for a new project.
Another fascinating aspect of the story is the friendship with Truman Capote, and putting this in this idea of her working on this project in the context of her working with Truman Capote. Much has been said about that relationship and about the working relationship and how one influenced the other. I'm curious as to what you discovered in that and how it added, I would assume, another layer into a rather kind of confusing picture of Harper Lee.
Yeah, so I mean, for listeners who don't remember this fact, Truman Capote had some family in Monroeville, and he spent quite a few of his childhood years, and even when he had moved to New York, quite a few weeks every summer visiting the Falks. And in one of these incredibly, you know, interesting collusions of geography and genius, you know, not only are they in this tiny town together, they literally live, you know, next door to one another, and there's a tiny stone wall between them. And so they spent a lot of time together as children. And then when Harper Lee moved to New York, Truman Capote had already moved there. And, you know, he was supposed to get her a job at Mademoiselle, and that didn't work out. But he made the introduction to the couple who gave her the money to take time off to write To Kill a Mockingbird. So it's this cauldron of creativity, and they wrote stories together as children, and they were in touch all through, you know, the years she spent at the University of Alabama. And then in New York, you know, when he needs someone to go with him out to Kansas to work on In Cold Blood, she accompanies him. And, you know, that's, I think those are facts that most listeners will know, or at least, you know, can summon once reminded of them. But there's some new material in the book that comes from correspondence Lee maintained with folks out in Kansas after In Cold Blood had been published, and with Capote's fact checker at The New Yorker. And it complicates the friendship. And I think that folks are aware that there was friction because of Capote's drug usage and his kind of difficult personality as the years went on. But there was also some friction around the choices he made in In Cold Blood. And since Harper Lee had been around, not just for that initial reporting trip, but several subsequent ones too, and she had her own independent relationships with characters in the book that Capote produced, she had very strong opinions about the kind of porous boundary between fiction and nonfiction in the book that he wrote. And, you know, she was a woman of strong opinions, and that included about genre. And quite interestingly, it seems like some of what she was up to with her own true crime project in Alexander City in the 70s was a kind of correction for what she had helped Capote do in Kansas. And in fact, she articulated very deliberately to people in town and in the years after she had started The Reverend that she was undertaking, you know, quote, an old-fashioned project, you know, journalism of the strictest kind, only facts. And, you know, she really went around beating this drum that she was not going to exaggerate. She was not going to fictionalize. She was not going to fabricate. She was only going to find facts around this original story. And that seems all to have been in contrast to Capote. And, you know, that correspondence I mentioned is new and quite revealing. And I think in general, what I hope readers find here is on the one hand a sweet relationship, almost sibling-like, according to people who encountered them together, you know, two writers who came from this small town and had these tremendously successful literary careers, but also a frictive relationship and one where, you know, there were real differences of opinion around journalistic ethics and around the ethics of how you represented real people's lives in nonfiction. So, you know, it's a relationship that follows Lee her whole life long, and I actually think one of the saddest scenes in the book is her attending Capote's memorial service, right when she's really struggling with her own true crime book. And I hope that readers find that moving because it was so interesting to me to think about how many more years she lived. So that memorial was in 1984, but, you know, Lee lived until 2016, so she had a lot of time to think about Capote and the difference between their, you know, public lives as writers and the difference between their actual material output as writers.
Okay, now for the questions that are impossible to answer.
Right. There are many. Is the moment. All the ones I so, you know, carefully avoided, you know, putting my thumb on the scale for, all right, let's have it. Lay them on me.
Well, one, of course, is that, and this goes back to Ghost of the Watchman, we can assume, yeah. I mean, it was always my assumption that if she, for so many years, had decided that she didn't want to publish anything else, that if she had really wanted that out in the world, it would have been out in the world. And you wonder the same thing about the Reverend. And as you point out, we don't know if an entire manuscript of the Reverend exists or not. Did she write the entire book? Did she finish it? And who knows, in a year or two, is the publisher going to say, oh, we have this book called The Reverend by Harper Lee. We don't know that.
Yeah, I mean, I promise I'm not playing coy with readers in the book. And, you know, for folks who do pick it up, they'll see. I try as best as I can to kind of collect all of the most reasonable opinions about her work on this case. And that's from friends and family who were close with her at the time. That's from sources in town in Alexander City who she interviewed for the project, what she told them. And there's really two, you know, poles of opinion. And one is that this was a very dark time in her life, and she had her own personal demons with depression and drinking, and she was not a tremendously functional person. And so despite the energy and enthusiasm she brought to the reporting, she struggled with the writing. And so that pole of folks thinks she really wasn't able to produce much, just a few pages. You know, there might be reporting notes, there might be cassette tapes of the interviews she conducted, but there's not a manuscript. You know, there's nothing you can put between two covers that you could call The Reverend by Harper Lee. Now, you know, there's an opposite pole of people, and those are folks who knew her sister. She had two older sisters. One is Alice, who most people know because Alice was an attorney like their father in Monroeville, but she had another sister in Eufaula, Alabama, over near the Georgia line. And for a few years, when she was coming and going to work on The Reverend, Harper Lee stayed with that other sister, Louise. And people who know Louise say, you know, Louise told him Harper Lee wrote the whole book. She did it at her kitchen table, and it was better than In Cold Blood. And so that other poll of folks are completely convinced she finished the book. There was a complete manuscript. Either she chose not to publish it because she was afraid of the Reverend's living accomplice, which was a fact she shared with some other folks interested in the case, that the Reverend did have a living accomplice. Other people say that she completed the book and the publisher didn't want it because the racial politics were so scandalous and it would be, you know, too controversial a work from the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, or just that she didn't want to put herself in the public eye again. But there is a complete manuscript. It was, you know, put away, tucked away, same as Ghost at a Watchman, and there might well be a full book, you know, that would be published posthumously. And those are two very real poles. And, you know, I found myself on a little bit of a roller coaster reporting this book because, you know, one day you'd interview one of the folks who was so convinced she hadn't put it together and you'd think, well, they're right. You know, she really was struggling with all these things. And the next day you'd interview someone else who was completely convinced that the whole thing existed and was in just another bank vault in Monroeville. And you think, oh, who's right? And, you know, in addition to those two poles about the kind of work product she actually produced, there's a whole other camp of people who say she wrote the whole thing but destroyed it. Because, in fact, there are, you know, people who lived in the same building as her in New York and people who knew her in Monroeville who heard directly from Harper Lee that she had destroyed entire manuscripts. You know, they went down the incinerator. She, you know, just abandoned them. And so those are folks who say, you know, yeah, she wrote it, but probably she didn't save it, so we'll never be able to read it. And, you know, again, I'm not playing coy. It's not as if I know and won't tell you. I've tried as best I can to, you know, kind of accurately represent, you know, what people who knew her at the time and people who encountered her were told or surmised or were led to believe. So, yes, it's a bit of a mystery. And the book ends with quite a cliffhanger because, of course, the archive of Harper Lee, the literary assets are sealed. And so there's no public inventory and there's no public timeline on when those materials will be available. So, you know, again, it's hard to know if in a year or two we're all going to be reading The Reverend or if we're going to be reading notes like the notes she made for Capote that are at the New York Public Library. You know, those are notes where every single reporting day she would, you know, record who she interviewed, what they said, and kind of write up her theory of the case. And she was doing the same thing in Alexander City, and I've seen one page of those from 1978. So even if there's not a full manuscript, in another year or two, we could really just have a tremendous body of, you know, material that would tell us more about her work on this case, which even that would be tremendously exciting.
You laid out several theories just a second ago. The last one seems the most implausible of just destroying the manuscript, and only because not the certainly the idea of her destroying manuscripts of other things seems plausible. But the idea of this, just in the way that you've described it, is difficult to believe because of the time, just how much time and how interested she seemed in the actual case.
Sure, although I'll give you the caveat that plausibility doesn't care about our feelings, and
right. No, that's
as much
true.
As we would all like, you know, to read everything Harper Lee wrote, you know, I tell a story in the book and I can tell you I sat with one of her neighbors and it's, you know, a husband and wife and they lived in the same building as her on the Upper East Side and, you know, knock, 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 2 a.m, there's Harper Lee wanting more to drink and telling them she's just put 300 pages in the incinerator. And, you know, that is grievous to those of us who love her work and would read it, you know, even in the rawest, most unedited form. And, you know, yet there it is. And it comes reliably delivered by, you know, two people who are just as pained to share that story as we are to hear it. And I think that, you know, Harper Lee really did struggle. And, you know, that's probably obvious to folks who think about this tremendous period of time she spent not publishing. And, you know, she had this infrastructure of family and she had these very loving agents and she had, you know, a very attentive editor, all of whom would love to have seen her put more work in the world. You know, I think it's even more tragic when we can follow her work on a case like The Reverend. But of course, even those fiction manuscripts, you know, there's this great letter I quote in the book from 1958 where Harper Lee is writing to the couple who gave her the Christmas gift that let her take time off from work to write To Kill a Mockingbird. And she tells them she's outlining the next 15 years of her work as a novelist. And, you know, it's tremendously interesting stuff. You know, it's like, you know, what Graham Greene calls an entertainment, you know, a novel of the United Nations, India 1910, you know, these tremendously interesting projects she hoped to write, you know, any one of which she could have started and abandoned or started and destroyed. And, you know, there is a lot of sadness in this book over, you know, what a tremendously gifted writer could have done, and some might say should have done, you know, had all the talent and ambition to do, but life conspired against her and, you know, any number of factors kept her from producing more work.
It is safe to say that had she gone ahead, we don't know, but had she gone ahead and written about this case, the case in and of itself is fascinating.
Yeah, so I hope there's joy for readers. You know, if you're just in it for Harper Lee, you're going to be a bit impatient because the first 2/3 of the book really is about the original case. And, you know, I try and tell you what you need to know so that you can understand her work and appreciate, you know, the ambition of the project she undertook. But, you know, when you sit through the original deaths from 1970 to 1977 and you get to know this tremendously interesting lawyer, you just realize, you know, gosh, she really had an eye for incredible stories.
Casey Sepp's new book is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.